So we're going to see this tension. We're going to see cartoons like No Popery, and for popery, read Catholicism. And they get quite virulent and quite funny, actually, if you're in an anti-Catholic mood, which I can't be teaching at Duquesne, but they're still quite funny. And you see Scots fighting quite hard to keep their Presbyterianism separate. This is them holding the king to the grindstone to say, don't kill the Presbyterian church. Okay, so that's just going to be a running thread throughout the chronology that I'm building here. How much does the Presbyterian church keep Scotland, Scotland, versus how much do those distinctions not matter versus, and we're all Protestant together? Does that make sense? Okay. So there's also this important split within Scotland. I don't want you guys to think all Scots are Scots the same. You've probably heard of the Highlands of Scotland, and this is just a map to show you where the Highlands are. The darker green is what's considered the Highlands. It's a split at the Great Glen, which is a geographic feature from the Ice Age. And if you remember from last week, I was saying that Presbyterianism never really made it into the farther reaches of Scotland. So we see Catholicism hanging on mostly in the Highlands, mostly in the west, north, and the islands. And these areas still speak Gaelic as a first language. So we have a split in Scotland linguistically and religiously. And this is important because it creates, you know, it's really simple for us now to say that Scotland and England are two different places, that there was a unified Scottish identity and a unified English identity. All Scots wanted the same thing. All English people wanted the same thing. But actually, the lowlands of Scotland, that lighter green or gray area, had more in common often, especially early in the 18th century, with English people than they did with these Western Highland people. You know, remember, they're not traveling a lot within Scotland. You wouldn't get a lot out of your village. And they're not speaking the same language. They're not practicing the same religion. It would be easier to see yourself maybe economically tied and socially and culturally tied to the English than it would be to these strange, barbaric, Catholic, strange language-speaking Highlanders. So we can't really fall into the trap of thinking all Scots are the same and have the same goals. So this is where we get the Jacobite rebellions. Have you heard of these before? We have two of these, and the first one is in 1715. And it's a religious thing, it is. This is asking a lot of you, but last week I had said that there was, you know, this crisis of monarchy where people were getting their heads chopped off and there was no one to lead, and that's why we had the Union of the Crowns. There have been a bunch of those moments where it was like, who was going to be the king? And the Hanovers, in the end, from Germany, who are still actually the family in charge now, had come, and they were Protestant, and they were the ruling family of Britain, which is why Protestantism is so important to British identity. But that had meant that the Stuarts, the Catholic dynasty, had been kicked out. So the Catholic Highlanders, you know, they didn't necessarily like that. So they wanted James, the Stuart, the guy who would have been king if the Stuart dynasty had been allowed to continue as kings and queens of Scotland. They wanted him back on the throne. They were like, we don't like these Protestant kings of Britain. We want the Stuarts back in charge. And the Stuart supporters, they tried to stage a coup, and they did pretty well. But what happened is when James himself actually got into the battlefield, he was kind of a wimp. And he was like, it's snowing. I don't think we're going to win this fight. Why don't we give up and try again? So he was not so good with the fighting. And they gave up and they were all, you know, arrested and killed. And it didn't go so well. The 15, not so good as far as rebellions. Not a good idea. They lost. Not a good plan. Bad rebellion. They didn't lose hope, though. They published a lot of engravings and a lot of books saying how fantastic and heroic it was. This is a picture of one of their great battles. And so it kept the legend of the Jacobites alive. It said, we could do this. We could take Scotland back for the Catholic rebellion, the Stuarts. And it kind of floated around in everyone's head for a while. So they tried again. In 1745, the son of James, he was living in France. He was living in Italy, then he was living in France. And the supporters of the Stuarts, they got together a lot of money, and they were like, Charles, you know what? You could give up your fancy life, and you could come, and you could lead us in Scotland. He's really young. He's 20. And he's like, hey, I'd like to be king. Awesome, I could take back my rightful throne of Scotland. I like it. He looks pretty, like he's having a pretty good life, yeah? He's like, I could lead an army. I could take back Scotland. I like it. They had a lot of success. A lot of the clans, the Highland clans, flocked to the Stuart army. They did really well. They got all the way into England. Again, there's not a clear Scottish-English divide. A lot of English people that were unhappy with the English crown joined the Jacobites. A lot of Scots were fighting supposedly on what we consider the English side. They got all the way to sort of the mid part of England before being turned back. They had a disastrous final battle, though. Again, Charles, he's young. He's not a very good commander. He makes some foolish decisions. They don't have enough food. They don't have a well-organized army, and they have this disastrous final battle on Culloden Moor. If you're ever in Scotland, I recommend that you go to the visitor center at Culloden. They have a great visitor center where you can do this self-driving tour where it picks up your GPS and gives you information of all the bits of the battle. It's fantastic. It's won a lot of awards. This is a picture of the battle, and you can see, it's a famous painting, you can see that the Highlanders are, A, they are portrayed as being entirely in what we see as Highland gear, the kilts and everything. They're portrayed as being, you know, entirely Scottish, which wasn't the case, but we can also see that they are just being murdered. And after this battle, it's really a Catholic versus Protestant battle. This is a religious battle. The Catholics on one side, the Protestants on the other, both Scots and English. And after this, Britain passes a law banning Catholicism and banning kilts, banning tartan. All of those things are completely banned. You can be hanged for having tartan for about 20 years. It's called the Diskilting Act and the Anti-Tartan Act, because they see these things as symbols of treachery and of treason. So this really tramples the Highlands of Scotland. And it's, again, it starts emigration to the States and to Canada. And it enhances this idea of Britain as a Protestant nation. Yes, it was definitely a Catholic rebellion.
And so there was the first rush of immigration to the colonies at the time were the Catholic Scots.
Yes. I mean, there had been, I talked last week about the Covenanters, the extreme Protestants. They had migrated as well. But this was a rush of Catholics, too. We have multiple waves of migration, but there was a big wave after the 45 because the extreme measures put onto the Highland after after Culloden led to famine and led to a lot of problems, so lots of people migrated then. They came a lot to Virginia and South Carolina, possibly up to Baltimore as well. I'm not sure of Scott's colonies in Baltimore, but I know South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, so it makes sense that they would go up to Baltimore as well. Sure. I'll talk about anything to do. This is my thing, Scotland, so anything you want, I'll do it all. I mean, my whole class this last semester was Modern Scotland 1707 to the present, so I had a really hard time getting this entire topic down to 50 minutes, believe me, because I just had 15 weeks on this. So in the 18th century after Culloden, what we saw in Scotland was what we call Romantic nationalism and Unionist nationalism, was this really wanting to get away from anything that can be seen as too Scottish, because the kilt had been banned, they had these rebellions, they just wanted to say, oh, we're not going to do that again, we're sorry, central government, please, we're not going to do that. So we had the Diskilting Act, the Tartan Acts, all of that. And instead, as we move into the 19th century, all of that became fodder for literature instead of politics. And we see things like, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Ossian poems, but you might enjoy them. This guy, Macpherson, he claimed to discover these ancient epic poems of Ossian. He said, I was looking around in an archive and I found this ancient epic of Ossian about the ancient history of Scotland. Turns out he wrote them instead of discovered them, but it was still, it was a bestseller in 1795. Very, very popular in Germany and in the US about the romantic history of early Scotland. We also have this guy, who's Robert Burns, if you recognize him, again, starting to write about the differences, write in Scots dialect, and write about how Scotland was different than England, but not in a threatening way, in a romantic way, in a historical way. Not talking about politics, not even really, we don't see a lot about religion in this time. We don't see anyone stressing the real differences between Presbyterianism and Anglicanism. This is the time of the Enlightenment. This is the time that's focused on science. This is a time of real learning in Edinburgh and Glasgow. They're being incredibly careful to talk about things as ancient history, things as literature and learning, but not stressing the things that actually politically could be dangerous, like religious differences or like political differences. They're selling Scotland sort of as a brand, but as a brand that's cute and historical and tourist-worthy. This is to say, we're not going to actually break away. We're just an interesting thing to look at. And this, all this sort of work that cultural people did, that writers did, that thinkers did, to kind of make Scotland safe again, culminated in the first visit of a British monarch to Scotland ever, since the Union of the Crowns, really, in 1822. And this is a picture of the scene. It didn't come out really as well as I wanted, but this is the visit of George IV to Edinburgh in 1822. And if you're able to look, you can see actually that this is everyone in the scene is in kilts. So this is the first time that you'll see public manifestation, public images of people in kilts since the Jacobite Rebellion. It's now safe. And the monarch himself thought that this was so adorable that he got himself a kilt. He got himself painted in a kilt. And this was the official okay to Highland dress. Now it was just a fashion. Now it was just, oh, I'm going on holiday to Scotland and I think I'll get myself one of those just very interesting looking outfits they wear there. It's no longer a symbol of war. It's just a symbol of something interesting that they do there. One of their strange little quirks. And this is why we call this unionist nationalism. This is national identity, but within the confines of the union with the rest of Great Britain. This is saying we want to be part of the union, we just want to hold on to our distinctiveness as well. It's a very 19th century thing. They're steering away from mentioning religion and politics like you would at a fancy dinner party, but they're trying to very carefully insert a little bit of visual difference, a little bit of cultural difference. Walter Scott writes the first historical novel with Waverley in 1814, and he talks about their in the historical fiction using the history of Scotland, and he makes it sort of romantic and wild. Tourists start visiting the Highlands on the first tourist trips. So Scotland becomes not barbaric, but interesting. But we see, it's interesting, this is the time that we see absolutely no mention of Presbyterianism. We know it's there, we know a lot of people are going to church, but it's not mentioned in any historical documents. They're not fighting for it at all. They're just kind of quietly doing their church thing. It's a real absence from the record. It's almost as if they know it's fraught. They know if they mention it too much, people will start thinking of them as different in a possibly dangerous way again. So they just go to church, do their thing, don't talk about it. What do you think of that? Does it surprise you? Is it interesting? Is it weird? Yes. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Scotland is the most literate part of the UK. And this is why Scottish men, because it's only men, but they are really highly sought after as clerks for the empire, because they are highly literate, and it's the Presbyterian Church that makes that happen. Because a central tenet of Presbyterianism is that everyone has to be literate enough to read the Bible, which means that they are then literate enough to do accounts for the East India Company and the rest of the empire. So that is really why we know that people are going to church, is because we know that they're literate and they end up in the empire. Yeah, I mean, there are still a lot of Catholics. The Jacobite Rebellion hasn't stamped out Catholicism, but increasingly as we go through the 18th and 19th century, there's just toleration of Catholics, and they're not fighting wars. They're allowed, especially in Scotland, to hold public office and things like that. They just kind of do their thing, and it's not a big deal anymore. If you ask 10 historians, you'll get 10 different answers for the date of the Industrial Revolution. I'd say about 1840, and it is quite industrial in the central belt of Scotland. So the economy really picks up. There was a question over here. Yes, definitely. Yep, the military and the foreign service. Yes. Actually, because of the Jacobite rebellions, they are seen as fierce fighters, and they're seen as great assets for the military. we have a lot of Scottish regiments in the army. And that's actually the one place where it's okay to wear a kilt, is part of the military, is part of your military uniform.
But the kilt was folded differently, so you didn't see the clan tartan. Wasn't it you only saw?
No, it's just a different tartan. It's a military tartan rather than a clan tartan. You have an emergence of a different type of Scottish nationalism as we get to the end of the 19th century that is a little bit more, I don't want to say church-focused, but involves the church, maybe. This is actually a stained glass window from Livingston in Scotland, and it is of Livingston in Africa. This is David Livingston, who discovered important parts of Africa, and it shows you Scottish involvement in the empire and how proud Scots are and Scots towns are of involvement of the Scottish people around the world. I think it's just really interesting. You'll see examples of these type of stained glass windows in various churches around Scotland. I just happen to love this one because it shows a scene so clearly. We have David Livingston, explorer, Scottish hero, sort of exploring Africa, meeting, you know, native peoples, and then being immortalized in his hometown church. I think that's really great, and that is one of the earliest ways in which Scottish nationalism happens, is a pride in the sort of achievements of Scottish people and saying we're not being recognized for it enough. In 1853, we have the National Association for the Vindication of Scottish Rights, which I think is a great name, and they compare themselves a lot to Ireland. They say Ireland gets all these rights and we don't. Why? Why don't we get home rule? Why don't we get to control our own self? And in doing this, they say the National Covenant, which I talked about last week, which is the document that says Presbyterianism can never be changed by the British government, by the English government. You can't control what Presbyterianism does. They say the National Covenant is not being respected, and one reason that Scotland should be given home rule is to protect documents like the National Covenant. This argument doesn't work for them. They don't get home rule in the 1850s, but you see this argument over and over again as Scottish nationalism keeps going into the 20th century. One of the things that they keep arguing for is, what about Presbyterianism? The Anglican Church can crush Presbyterianism. What about the rights of our church? Because remember that I said last week, Presbyterianism is kind of in this legal limbo. The royal family has kind of said, okay, you can have your own church, but we won't really legally recognize it. It's been like that since 1690. It's still like that at this period in time that we're talking about right now. They haven't actually made a law to say, yes, the Presbyterian Church exists. So when the Association for the Vindication of Scottish Rights says the National Covenant isn't being respected, they're right. If the royal family wants to turn around and say, no Presbyterian Church, legally they can do that. It's a worry. So we have to talk about the church and law for a second here. They're in this legal limbo. It's a problem. Yes, in 1707 they said that the church can exist separately, but that was just kind of a pinky promise because there's no law supporting that. It's like the Magna Carta, like they wrote it down, but they don't have an official constitution. So, kind of like, okay, we'll respect it, but we could change our mind. This had led to a lot of splits between the church. I don't know if you knew this, but there are like 100 different Presbyterian churches at some point in Scotland. There's the Little Presbyterian Church and the Free Presbyterian Church and the United Presbyterian Church and the Disunited Presbyterian Church, because every time that they have a disagreement about something, they just go off and form their own church because there's no law saying there's one Presbyterian church. Yes. So finally, in 1921, think about this, 1690 to 1921, Parliament, the British Parliament, passed a law, the Church of Scotland Act, saying that the church had full independence. It's a long time. This meant that they could unify a little bit. The ones that wanted to, kind of, you know. If you wanted to agree, if you wanted to be grouped under the Church of Scotland. There's still the Wee Free Church. Great name, kind of crazy church. I like their name, though. So this is kind of too small to read, but I thought, if any of you want me to send you this, I found it. One of my friends had created it. I thought maybe you would get a kick out of it. It's a timeline of all the different splits within the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. I don't know. I thought maybe you would like it, but it turned out kind of too small to read. So it's all the different...
They use the same book order.
Some of them do. Some of them have their own. Some of them don't have any, from what I know. Those Scots, you know, they go their own way. Yeah.
My dad came over from Scotland in the 1890s as a Catholic, their family was Catholic. What would their life have been? Were they Minorians or? They were down in Glasgow, they were near Glasgow. What would their life have been? Would they have been a recognized church?
The Catholics?
The Catholics were. But what was there? Were they a minority? Were they a majority?
In Glasgow, they were probably a majority.
Really?
Yeah. And it depends on their social class. They could have been pretty well off. In the 1880s, they could have been living in what we call a tenement house and been not very well off and had a poor life. Or they could have been, you know, pretty well off entirely.
They were from a little town outside Glasgow called Coatbridge.
Coatbridge, then they probably weren't very, they probably were living, again, many people in a small room in a tenement. Probably weren't doing that well.
My grandmother was a milliner, I think, she had a little house.
Oh, well, she had a trade. I can talk to you more about this after. No, I can give you a summary of what they were probably like, yeah. So this is a idea of who unified and who got tangled up and where we are at now with the denominations in Scotland of all the different... No, not even denominations, the different parts of Presbyterianism. You guys, with your tangled church, I don't even know. But it's kind of crazy. So, and then we have Northern Ireland, just to get a little complicated here. I won't go into the troubles in Northern Ireland in great depth, but Northern Ireland impacts Scotland a little bit, so I'd feel bad if I didn't talk about it. Northern Ireland, I mean, obviously it existed, but the country itself created in 1921. It's six Protestant counties that were split off from the Free State when Ireland was given its independence from Great Britain, stopped being a colony of Great Britain. And the Protestantism of Northern Ireland, an important part to Scotland, is that the Protestantism in Northern Ireland is largely due to the fact that Lowland Scots were relocated there or encouraged to emigrate there when they were trying to make Ireland Protestant when Britain still had Ireland as a colony. So there are lots and lots and lots of Scots in Northern Ireland because it was Scots who were told, we'll give you land to farm, we'll make you landlords if you go to Northern Ireland and sort of make it Protestant by force, kind of infuse Protestantism to Northern Ireland. So that's kind of why we have Northern Ireland and Ireland, is because of Scots way back when. And this is the flag of Northern Ireland. And you can see, if you're familiar, you know that that background is the flag of St. Andrews, the flag of Scotland. So you can see the Scottishness infused right in the flag of Ulster, which is Northern Ireland. This is why we have what we call the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It's Scotland. And then it also goes over to America. This is a mural. Murals are really important in Northern Ireland. This is how people show their allegiance and the allegiance of geographic areas. A lot of our American presidents, there's also a mural of George Washington that I didn't show here because the quote wasn't as good. This is James Buchanan. Someone's made a mural of James Buchanan. We don't pay attention to James Buchanan, but people in Northern Ireland do, because he said right here, my Ulster blood is my most precious heritage. Buchanan, obviously a Scottish name, but his family came from Northern Ireland via Scotland. And people in Protestant Northern Ireland have made this mural of him to show this connection, to show this is marking a Protestant area in Northern Ireland. So the tangled web between Northern Ireland and Scotland and Protestant identity is quite deep. And this is where we get into sectarianism today. Sectarianism, the fight between religions. The Irish Troubles spill over into modern Scotland. Glasgow particularly sees fights between the Orange Order, which is the sort of militant Protestant group, I guess. This is an Orange Order march. And others, there are two football or soccer teams in Glasgow. One, Celtic, is traditionally Catholic, and one, Rangers, is traditionally Protestant. And the first thing I was told when I went to Glasgow is, don't go to Glasgow on a football day. Because the fights still today break out between rival supporters. And I'm talking like not fist fights. I'm talking fights with broken bottles, fights with knives. First thing I was told, don't go on public transportation in Glasgow. Don't go in certain areas of Glasgow on a football day. Not to say that all supporters of these football teams are that particular religion or even go to church, but the idea that you're either a Celtic person or a Rangers person and your family always has been is so ingrained that these identities, based historically on religion, are very crucial. When Celtic, the Catholic team, signed a Protestant player, there were riots in the street. And that was only about 15 years ago. It's a huge deal, sectarianism. They have a whole crime unit in Scotland devoted to it. This is the back of their jackets. You see them on the streets. It is a huge deal. And it is because of this history of religion and geography and identity that's embedded in the culture. So we get to Scottish independence, which you've probably heard about in the news in the last couple of years. And how is that intertwined with religion? Well, it is and it isn't. It really kicked off in the 1970s when they discovered oil in the North Sea. Oil and political movements always intertwine. And it also just happened to be side by side with the election of Margaret Thatcher. Scotland historically has always voted more liberally than the rest of Britain, so they were represented by someone that they hadn't voted for. If you look at the voting maps, really no one in Scotland voted for Margaret Thatcher, and they all of a sudden had this oil wealth. So you see a lot of posters like this. And I'm talking, you see a lot of images like this. Margaret Thatcher still is hated in Scotland. When she died fairly recently, the song Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead became the number one selling single in Scotland. Really, really reviled. So the phrase, "It's Scotland's oil," was the phrase for the first push of independence. They didn't get independence in the 70s, obviously. They didn't even get devolution. The word devolution is just a phrase for something similar to our federal system. It would give, or does give, a parliament to Scotland, similar to like the Pennsylvania House, and then still has the central government. Some powers in Scotland, some powers in the central government. Does that make sense? The church was actually active in supporting devolution. They normally are neutral on political matters, but they really actively supported devolution, particularly because they took an anti-nuclear stance. Britain's nuclear weaponry is stored in Scotland. Can't really tell you why, other than that it is. Scottish people are anti-nuclear. The rest of Britain, if you poll them, are kind of positive on nuclear weaponry. Scottish people, vehemently anti-nuclear. The Scottish church, anti-nuclear. I think this is the reason that the church supported devolution. Devolution does not give Scotland the power to get rid of nuclear weapons, but maybe it's a movement towards that.
Why did we have our big FDM base there?
Hmm?
We had our free ballistic missile base there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's still there.
I don't think it's still there, but it was. Yeah, we did. The church was also given a large voice in how to set up the new parliament. Scotland's not as big on separation of church and state. The church is a state body, and so it was given a large voice in how to set up the new parliament, and everyone supported that. This is just telling you what powers the devolved government has. Sports, culture, things like that. Health. Education, again, control of the church, doesn't have tax powers or military powers. So pretty much similar to what states have versus what the government has here. We had an independence referendum in 2014. We had the two opposing forces here. We have the simple sort of yes, Scotland, versus better together, a stronger Scotland. A united kingdom. And it comes right back full circle to what we saw in 1707. Are we going to be a united Protestant identity, or are we going to be, sticking to what makes us unique and Scottish? And the Yes campaign was really saying that independent Scotland would again be able to get rid of nuclear weapons, would be greener, more equal, more open to immigration. Better Together was saying, you'll never make it on your own. It's unrealistic. We've always been united. The more things make us, similar than make us different. The votes, this is a graph saying self-described national identity. I don't know if you can read that. This is based on what's called the Moreno scale, which has been around for a really long time. It's a great way to ask people how they identify. You can see it goes from, are you Scottish, not British? More Scottish than British? Equally Scottish and British? More British than Scottish? British, not Scottish? Or other? It's a great way. They use it a lot in Europe to say, are you Spanish, more Spanish than European, equally Spanish and European, you know, et cetera. It's a great way. We use it a lot in nationalism studies. And you can look, if you look, we usually look at the left two bars to look at nationalist feelings. So if you look at the left two bars, Scottish, not British, more Scottish than British, that's half the population. And if you include the left three bars, equally Scottish and British as well, that's an overwhelming amount of the population. And this, these left two bars have been ticking up steadily since the 70s. And if you look at the right two bars, more British than Scottish or British, not Scottish, that's a tiny, tiny part of the population. So people are really identifying as Scottish, or at least as Scottish and British equally. And that number has been going up. That number didn't translate to independence, obviously, but it was pretty close. And people that have analyzed the vote have said that it was economic fear more than national identity that change people, because right up until the results of the vote, it was looking like it might go yes, but that in the ballot box, probably people feared economics, especially because the plan was always for Scotland to join the EU as an economic safety net, but that the EU was, Spain particularly, was incredibly against them joining the EU because it would set a precedent for other breakaway areas. So without confirmation that joining the EU would be possible, people got scared at the last minute. This is a graph that will tell you people's religious identity along with the graph that we just looked at with the votes. So you can see that a majority of Catholics voted yes. A minority of Church of Scotland voted yes. Majority of people with no religion stated voted yes. I just think it's an interesting graph to look at to see if religious identity has any bearing on how people voted in the referendum. I don't know. I haven't really analyzed these numbers enough to know if there's any correlation or causation here, but be interested to see if you have any thoughts on these numbers. Obviously, people that are Church of England voted no in great numbers, which is probably clear. I don't know. I just thought it was an interesting graph to put up. I was a little bit surprised. I would have thought the Church of Scotland would have been higher yes numbers. This is something telling us that church attendance has gone down. I think all of you would say that church attendance has gone down in the last 10 years. It's true in Scotland as well. These numbers are a little bit different than other numbers that I've read. The Church of Scotland says that its numbers are higher than this graph. They say that they have about 34% of the population. This graph says less than that. But it's still the highest attendance of any church in Scotland today. They are having a lot of problems with finding ministers, though. Aging population, lack of ministry candidates, and they have a congregation splitting off because of opposition to gay issues, disputes over Israel. There's a big issue in Scotland about, some document over support on Palestine and supposedly lack of support on Israel. I can link you to the actual document if you're interested. There's a very cute video that they just made to get more young people into ministry that I can also link you to if you want. I was going to show it to you, but it's like 12 minutes long. If you want to see some adorable young ministers on islands, then I can show you that. They are actively involved in society, though. They're the largest provider of care homes for the elderly. They're the largest voluntary organization with the Women's Guild. They have a really large youth council, and they have a lot of political organizations. So they're really embedded in Scottish society. And even if people don't say that they go to a Church of Scotland organization, they probably are touched by a Church of Scotland organization through all these other things that they do in society that they people don't know about. I guess I'm done without knowing that I'm done. I forgot that that was the last thing. So, yeah, any questions? Sorry, I didn't think it was so anticlimactic. Really? Have I just...
Does, do any churches in Scotland get stipends from the government?
Ooh, good question. I actually do not know the answer to that. I'm so sorry.
I've heard that they do.
I think that they do, yes. I think that they do, but I am unsure. Yeah. I know that there was a big problem when a bunch of really fancy large churches split away because they lost a lot of money. But I'm unsure how much money that they get from the government, if they get some.
What are some of the issues that the church split over and divided into so many different presbyteries?
Well, they split over... I know the We Freeze split over different prayer books and how liberal to be. Some split over the ordination of women and how the roles of women. A lot of it is how Calvinist to be, how hellfire to be. Different types of hymn singing, if you're allowed to sing. Different readings of the Bible. Different interpretations of theology, really. Yeah. It really just comes down to different theologies. And
when did they go?
1965? Is it 68? Something like that.
Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you would be willing to send me the chart, the principal,
sure.
A couple of links that I can have available for anybody, they can just contact me.
Okay, I can do that.
And I like Warren's suggestion about having you back, so you can hear it.
Okay, anytime.
Let's thank Olivia.